Moncrief on News Talk.
Now, sex is always complicated. While it's welcome that people should have a strong sense of consent, that doesn't necessarily lead to a great love life, because desire itself, particularly female desire, can be something of a mystery even to the woman. Catherine Angel is the author of Tomorrow Sex Will Be Good Again, and she joins us now on News Talk. Good afternoon, Catherine.
Hi.
Like, in principle, consent is a great thing, but is it perhaps too simplistic an approach to take?
Well, I think consent is absolutely vital. We should only have sex with people who want to have sex with us. And I think, you know, all the conversations that we've been having around consent are all to the good. The argument I make in the book is that the way in which some of the rhetoric around consent gets addressed, especially to women, actually overlooks the difficulties that women experience with sexuality. So we're often told, you know, especially in the wake of Me Too, lots and lots of discussions about this, that say to women, you need to know what you want, discover what you want sexually, and be really clear and confident about expressing that desire to your sexual partners. And that's all very well. But first of all, women's confident expressions of sexual desire are often what come back to haunt them. And we see this all the time in rape trials. We saw that in the Ched Evans case, where, you know, texts that women have written saying that they're up for sex get read out in court as evidence against them. But not just that, that knowing what we want can be difficult for all of us, and perhaps particularly if we live in a sexual culture that punishes sexuality. So the picture is really complex, which isn't to say that consent is not important. You know, consent is vital. But I'm trying to kind of encourage a way of talking about this that acknowledges that, you know, sexuality is lived in a culture, and that culture itself is really harmful to sexuality.
And do you see a distinct link between consent and knowing what you want, that those two things are seen as going together?
Well, I think that part of, you know, teaching people to kind of improve sexual relations and to have kind of good sexual communication should involve teaching them to navigate uncertainty. You know, it would be, I mean, it's the simple idea is that, you know what you want and you just say that, and hopefully you both want the same thing and then you get on with it. But of course, it's more complicated than that. Sometimes we start off wanting something and then we don't want it, or vice versa. We don't know. Sometimes we discover things that we enjoy. And it's that kind of murky space of exploration and curiosity that I think we're not taught about. You know, we're taught to kind of respect a yes and respect a no. But there's so much about sex life that is in that in-between space. So, you know, if somebody doesn't want to have sex with you, you should absolutely not have sex with them. And if somebody says that they want something, obviously you can take that seriously, but not presume that that's the be-all and end-all. You know, we have to constantly be open to discovering our own sexual desires, but also the changing desires of the other person.
That murky space, though, it's, you know, it's probably more straightforward to teach about consent, but that murky space, you know, it's so individual to each person and each couple that it'd be hard to educate people about it, or would it?
Well, I think it does. It does undoubtedly make it harder. And, you know, part of the reason we have leaned so much on these kind of very well-meaning formulae about consent is precisely that it's easier, you know, it's more appealing to have a kind of simple rule. But if the reality of sexual life and the reality of how differently men and women, you know, are treated in a sexual culture, if those realities actually mean that women suffer, then I think, you know, it's our duty to really try and open up that conversation. And I think, you know, that's about so many different things. It's about sex education that I think should start very early. And it's about, you know, the representations of sexuality that we see in the culture. And, you know, wouldn't it be great if we could teach young women and men and girls and boys to really be interested in the other person's experience, and to not see sex as something that we just acquire from one another or give up to one another.
It's more of an interactive process.
Yeah, it's a conversation. It's a social phenomenon. And there are all kinds of things that we do when, you know, when we have conversations with one another, which is that we, you know, we listen and we pay attention, and we kind of, you know, the ground is moving. We don't just think, I'm locked into this social interaction now forever.
Yes.
We're actually much more flexible.
And in terms of the amount of pressure some of these, as you know, obviously well-meaning things do place on women, in that consent, the woman has to operate like a sexual traffic light. Plus also in I suppose, an offshoot of the Me Too movement, women are encouraged to speak up, you know, if they've been raped or sexually abused in any way. But is your argument, as I understand it, that that's again putting a lot of pressure on a woman to kind of be a hero?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, the Me Too movement was so important in terms of, you know, bringing to light, you know, some of these kind of egregious abuses of power that happen. And I think, you know, women should feel able to tell their stories and to be supported in that. But my question is, ultimately, what does that kind of speech serve? Does it work out well for women? Does it create change? And I think that in the conversation around, you know, sexual dynamics and consent, again, we see this burden placed on women to be, you know, clear and to tell their stories and to tell their desire very clearly. But my worry is that that is placing the burden on individual women to manage the risk. It's a risk management strategy. And of course, we have to have risk management strategies in a world that is full of violence. And I, you know, how individual people cope with risk is completely, you know, that's just a thing they have to do. But my worry is that some of the rhetoric itself just keeps this focus on how individual women act and also what kind of sexual personalities they have. So there's this, you know, valorization of the very strong, confident woman who's not afraid to say what she wants. But the fact is, for a lot of women, sex is a realm, and not, you know, not just women, men are victims of sexual abuse and violence too. Sex can be a realm of real fear and, you know, real trauma. A lot of people are walking around with, you know, sexual abuse and physical and psychological memories of that. So this kind of injunction to embody this, you know, ideal, lustful, confident person just seems to me to ignore the reality and to place the burden again on women to resolve a problem that is a collective social ethical problem.
Is that connected to confidence feminism?
Yeah, so confidence feminism is a term I talk about in the book. It's a term that was coined by Roz Gill and Shani Orgad. And they argue that, you know, in recent years, there's been a kind of conflation of feminism with this sort of stance of individual confidence. So, you know, if you're going out in the world being assertive and overcoming challenges in your workplace, for instance, that becomes kind of synonymous with feminism. And they argue, I think rightly, that this is a kind of dilution of what feminism is. And again, it sort of involves placing the responsibility for social change onto individual women's behavior. And I think that, you know, one of the problems is that because women are shamed for their sexuality, and, you know, the double standard is so alive and kicking, we're made to feel ashamed for our sexual desire. It's very tempting to think that the solution to that problem is just to encourage women to reject shame and to be confident and proud. And that may be useful to say to women, you know, you deserve a sexual life and you shouldn't be shamed for feeling sexual desire. But what does that focus on our kind of individual behaviors and feelings do? It keeps the focus on us, and it takes the focus away on these kind of larger questions about gender, about what we think masculinity is, and what, you know, how men and women should behave, and who is responsible for sexual violence. And I think the conversation, you know, we need to keep resisting this idea that sexual violence is our responsibility, because it's a risk that we have to manage. It is a risk we have to manage, but it's not our responsibility.
Yes. And isn't it also a bit prescriptive about what kind of a sexuality each individual woman is supposed to have, if it's being held up as this kind of almost kind of macho version of it?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think, you know, in the history of kind of feminism, you often have this move where, you know, some of the book I talk about sex research and Masters and Johnson in the 60s and 70s. And in that period, you see this part of the feminist attempt to, you know, emancipate women from sexual repression and sexual unhappiness is to kind of encourage them to be what we think men are like. So to be, you know, lustful and to just kind of go out in pursuit of sex. And of course, women should be able to do that. And I support that wholeheartedly. But we have to be really careful not to just adopt these models of masculinity that actually don't serve men or women well. You know, indeed, everybody has a different sexuality. Sexuality, you know, it waxes and wanes. Sometimes you feel full of sexual desire in life and sometimes you don't. And, you know, sometimes you feel more brazen and confident and sometimes you feel afraid and vulnerable. And I think sexuality has to incorporate all of that. We have to be okay with the fact of vulnerability, not least because actually vulnerability is part of pleasure. We have to be able to be vulnerable to open ourselves up to pleasure. Yeah. So to stigmatize vulnerability, I think, doesn't do anyone any good in terms of, you know, the joy that can come from sex.
Indeed. Catherine, thanks very much for speaking with us today. That was Catherine Angel there, the author of Tomorrow Sex Will Be Good Again. You're listening to the Moncrief Show on News Talk. We're going to take a break, back in a couple of minutes.
Moncrief on News Talk.